We were talking yesterday at one of the panels about writing as a life and sort of the challenges of it. And one of the things that we were talking about was how much time you spend alone, or I spend alone in my shed in the backyard trying to write and pretending to write and full of self-doubt and guilt and self-loathing and all of these other very productive things. And I think that... You know, all that time, like I worked 10 years as a temp and did every odd job there was to try to find a way to live as a writer, and so that's where the guilt comes from, is when you sit there and you're not working and you're not getting work done and you're not doing anything and you're not feeling useful when you've been given this gift that you to be able to write and to have people listening. And I think that ultimately what we're always trying to do, and I feel like I need to do, is I got to feel useful on a daily and weekly and monthly and yearly basis. And so that's what intrigued me about Zaytoun's story in the first place, because his sense of purpose was so clear and so pure that I just wanted to learn from him and to hear him talk about it and to watch him continue that life. And this is a guy that stayed after, when the storm was bearing down, he stayed in his house, and when the water came up, or he had sent his family north, and when the water came up, he got in a canoe, and what he did was go around the neighborhood trying to look for people that might need his help. And on the first day, when he made the rounds, he heard a cry for help behind a door. He jumped into the water, went up to the door, banged it, couldn't open it, finally kicked it, ran his shoulder into it, finally it opened, and there he found a woman in her 80s floating near the ceiling, holding onto a bookshelf, crying for help. And she'd been there over 24 hours, and he was able to save that woman's life because he was in a canoe and because he was listening and because he had stayed. And so from that moment on, he was absolutely sure of why he was there. He was sure why he was in the city, why he had been stayed at home, why he had been bought this crazy secondhand canoe that he'd bought years before and had no other reason for it. All of these things were ordained by God, that he had a reason to be there, and this was his purpose. And so this intrigued me, that because this is what we're all striving for, and how often do we feel that? That we're absolutely sure of why we're here. You know, we long for this, and every so often we might hit upon it for a moment or two. But, and for many people, the times that you're, and for most people, I would say, the times when you're most sure of your purpose in life and your usefulness as a person is when you're coming to the aid of someone else. You're driving along and you're thinking of nothing in particular and you're at rest mentally and physically, and then somebody on the side of the road has a car, they need their tire changed, you pull over, you spring into action, and suddenly you feel like, yes, I'm here, I have a jack, I know how to do that, I can change your tire. And you walk around for days afterward electrified. That was it, you know. Everything else is completely dull by comparison. And I've had this experience where, like, every other meal, everything is like, oh, you know. But that tire that you could change, you know, that you felt like, okay, that's why I'm here. And so, and that for that brief period of time, it all makes sense. You make sense. Your arms and legs and skills or your experiences make sense. And so, and on one level, it's just an excuse, this need for help. It's an excuse to connect to a fellow human being. We walk through and past each other, and our very being, or down to our bones, we want to be connected to that person we pass by. But we have no conduit. We have no excuse. But when they need our help, that's our path. That's our reason to know someone's name. So Zaytoun was so electrified by saving that woman's life that he stayed. He sat on his rooftop. He set up a tent on his rooftop, on the roof of a home under 8 feet of water, and he could not wait every night till morning, till the sun rose, that he could get back into that canoe and get back in and look for more people to help. And this is how he said it. He said, I felt like it was lucky if I could find someone that needed me. So that's what he did. He kept it uncomplicated. He treated everyone he encountered without suspicion, without a head full of disinformation, with only the presumption of goodwill. And so he distributed food, water, he rescued people, he directed people to safety, he even fed a number of pets who had been left behind. And a week after he began, in one of the homes that he owned, he was arrested, handcuffed, thrown in a cage, called Al-Qaeda and Taliban, transferred to a maximum security prison, all without contact with family, an attorney, or anyone. No one listened to him. He was no longer the prosperous business owner, the husband, the father of five, the pillar of the community. He was a man in a cage. No one saw past this new identity. Guards passed him, soldiers, cops, doctors, prison guards, nurses, to every single one of them. He said, I'm a person. I have a family. I'm you. Take this number. This is my wife's number. Tell her where I am. But no one would do that simple act. No one would make a phone call for 3 weeks. And during that time, Kathy, his wife, was sitting at home waiting for him to call, not knowing what had happened to him. And after a few weeks, she had no choice but to believe that her husband, the love of her life, the father of her children, was dead. But after 3 weeks in the maximum security prison, finally one man listened. And it was fitting in a way that the man who finally looked at Zaytoun as a human being was a missionary handing out Christian literature. Here was a Muslim man in a rural prison who might have suffered God knows what fate in 2005, who might have been disappeared for far longer in the rabbit hole of the prison system. This man said, sure, I'll make that call. And that act of heroism freed Abdurrahman Zaytoun. And think of that, the fact that we're talking about an act of heroism that's a phone call. In 2005 in America, making a phone call was a heroic act. This was a moment in American history when we could have done better, where we responded to a humanitarian problem with a military solution, where we made assumptions about the people of New Orleans without listening, where we paid little attention to individual human rights, where we treated our own citizens very often as the enemy. The first year these awards were given out, the Lifetime Achievement Award went to Studs Terkel, the father of contemporary oral history. He was a hero of mine growing up in Chicago, and I had the chance to meet him a few years ago before he passed on. And he made a career out of listening, and I learned a lot from listening to him and watching him listen to others. And he said a great thing about listening and about America. He said, quote, I've always felt in all my books that there's a deep decency in the American people and a native intelligence, provided that they have the facts, provided that they have information. And that's so true. When I was taking on this book, I said to the Zaytouns, let's tell your story, and the story has to be told, but I'm afraid for you. Let's change your name. Let's disguise your identity so that if anybody has problems with Arab Americans, Muslim Americans, Islam, they won't be able to locate you. They won't be able to put their focus, their antipathy. They won't be able to direct it toward you. And I remember the Zaytouns were very against that idea, especially Abdurrahman. He said, you know, this is my story. This is my name. They had this very proud lineage. He built this business from scratch, Zaytoun Painting Contracting LLC. He did so much to sort of, and he has such pride in his name that he didn't want it taken away. And so finally, we agreed, okay, the book will have your name on it. It will be your story. And I still was so nervous, and we hired somebody to answer phones for them and all of this stuff. And we told them, don't Google yourself for a while. And all of these precautions. And then what happened when the book came out? Nothing. There were no threats. There were no crazy calls. There wasn't even an email to them that we had any negativity at all. All there was this incredible outpouring of support, of love, of affection, and more than anything, of apology. I'm going to read one of these letters that represents so many others that came through the mail just a few days ago. Hello. Not sure who will receive this email, but I wanted to send a message to Mr. Zaytoun and his family. I'm a white, middle-class, 47-year-old, fourth-generation Texas female who wants to say I'm sorry. I'm so sorry that you and your family endured ill treatment simply for being individuals different in color and religion from me, but the same in humanity. And thank you. Thank you for being an honest, decent, industrious family and remaining so after horrific treatment. And I'm sorry for the persecution you endured. I do not fear Muslims. Perhaps I am like you and only fear evil, which does not adhere to color, culture, religion, or gender, but is what all persons must stand against. Sincerely, Tammy L. Stewart. That was the deep decency that Studs Terkel was talking about, a deep decency that's in everyone when we have the facts, when we listen, when we presume the best in people, when we endeavor to understand. There was a recent statistic that said that 68% of Americans have never met a Muslim family themselves. And it's been gratifying to know that at least a few more people have gotten to meet a Muslim family through hearing their story, hearing the Zaytoun story. And they've gone through a lot, and they used to have a lawsuit against the city and the state and FEMA and Michael Brown and George Bush and Mayor Nagin and everybody in particular. It was two pages of names that they named on their lawsuit, and it was an act of anger to get back at what they had been through. But now, since they've gotten so much support, such an outpouring of affection, that the love that they feel has doused the flames of their anger, and this act of listening and of empathy has healed some of those wounds. War is only possible when the so-called enemy is dehumanized. When we deny or obscure their common humanity, it's easier to accept the atrocities of conflict. And so the best weapon we have against war is constant and unshakable empathy. It takes time, and it's damned hard sometimes to presume the best of everyone. I went to the University of Illinois, so it's hard for me to presume the best of those at Ohio State, for example. But still, we must assume that any family member, any family hiding in a bunker could be us, that any man in a cage could be you, your brother, your father, your husband. And here in Dayton, you've memorialized the act of listening. Here a heroic peace was signed through the act of listening, and here every year you nurture and honor that peace through continued acts of empathy and understanding. So I want to thank you and dedicate this to the Zaytoun family, who had faith in me over the many years it took to write the book, and who I consider my family now. I dedicate this to all those who listen, to all those who commit everyday acts of heroism that keep empathy alive and thus war at bay. Thanks a lot.